Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Lewis. It's a pleasure to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I have had an opportunity to look at your show notes. I think this is going to be a pretty cool conversation. But before we dive into that, how about you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thank you, Jason. It's such a pleasure to get to meet you in this podcast and everybody else who follows you. You certainly have quite a following. So thank you for having me. My name is Luis Diaz. I'm the Executive Director of Annual Giving at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. If you haven't made it out here as soon as it's possible, I invite everybody to do so. It's a wonderful organization in a wonderful place. So yes, Annual Giving at Muhlenberg.
Yeah. So Luis, I have to first and foremost, you're a Spanish guy, right?
Oh my goodness, it's complicated.
yeah, tell me who you are. You and I don't talk alike, so tell me who you are. Yeah,
I didn't expect this podcast to be like that. No, I'm joking. My mom is from California. My dad is from Spain. They met at UCLA when he was trying to pass his English classes. My mom was his English teacher, so the rest of it is history.
Yeah. Fascinating. I certainly appreciate that. And I think that'll add. And you're also an economics guy, right?
Yes. Studied a lot of economics and business. Also a musician. So I was doing both at some time. And it kind of all came together in development through an internship at Lincoln Center over a summer. I just kind of saw it all come together.
Yeah, I think as I was reading through the show notes, I was like, okay, this guy, he's a Spanish guy. I didn't pick up on the UCLA Southern California connection, but then the economics, and so I'm thinking, okay, here's a guy in fundraising, and I'm thinking this is going to be a very interesting topic, Lewis. So you shared with me some ideas in the show notes, and I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. I want to let you do that. So tell us what we're going to talk about today.
Well, I mean, I think it would be really interesting to hear what you think about the fact that we are kind of in a new era of engagement. And I may be going a little bit off the show notes now, but I truly have come to believe that we are in a, especially now during the pandemic and in the post-COVID world, we're coming into an era where engagement and donor engagement and constituent engagement will be critical for many organizations.
Yeah, I have some interesting opinions because of some of the writing that I'm working on right now. But you tell me first what your thinking is.
Sure.
You sort of tee this up, and then I'll jump on and put in my two cents. No doubt about it.
Love it. Love it. So, you know, we all know the statistics, the millions of households lost to philanthropy in the last 10 years. I've been fortunate enough to have a cross-section of experiences across large public, large private universities in the arts. Now at Muhlenberg, that's a really wonderful, I would say, even unique community. And I've come to learn the power that engagement has. And also I've seen that historically, our approach to fundraising has not been, let's say, we focused more on the tail end of engagement, right? At the very end. So if you think it's kind of, I've come to think of it almost as donor extraction, right? So you have a pool of people, relationships that you've developed, and we focused a lot on just the very last piece of it. But what I've seen is kind of the power that engagement has, and it has its own problems too. You have to measure it. You have to get people to buy into it. But we've done some really special things. We did an event that was really like a community event, in support of students impacted by COVID. And it was really this Zoom, it was basically like a huge Zoom call with people, and the energy that produces was really special. So, and then fundraising results to go with it. So, you see that across higher ed, across philanthropy as a whole. It's really something that, I feel future-facing fundraising shops need to be looking at. What do you think?
Yeah. So I have been looking at, are you familiar with the limits to growth studies that they did in the late, I think it was the late 1960s, early 1970s. And they were basically talking about the carrying capacity of the earth. Are you familiar with those studies?
No.
So I've been looking at those studies. So these are studies that basically were saying that the carrying capacity. So this was basically recognizing that the earth, these were systems thinkers, economists. This was sort of a blend of people from sort of a, and they were primarily at MIT. So they were sort of the early ranks of what we would call systems thinkers mixed with economists and ecologists. And they were basically saying that the earth sort of has this, just like any system, has sort of a limited carrying capacity. And at some point, population growth will sort of cause a, could and will presumably cause some sort of a collapse. And
that's very Malthusian, no? That's the
yes, very much all of that. Yes, 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 exactly. And so, and his name is woven into this, you know, over and over again. And that's what concerns me about fundraising more than anything else. The writing project that I'm working on right now is sort of on that, along that line. And it's this idea that any organization, large or small, whatever the mission that they happen to have, sort of has a carrying capacity, which is to say that there is some sort of limit that an institution like yours has. And that limit, once you've sort of exceeded that limit, you risk perhaps collapse. And it's not going to matter sort of how large the program gets.
You mean like a limit, but on the downside, right? So a limit of how little you can care for people. Is that what you mean?
I'm thinking in terms of population size. So if we sort of imagine, so the limits to growth study was all about the carrying capacity of the earth. So it was basically saying that the earth can have a human population of X number of people. And so if we apply the same logic to any institution, if we take the same sort of logic and we apply it to Muhlenberg, we basically say that there is a limit on the number of donors that your organization can sustain in any, to any standard, whatever that standard might be. And those standards, and that's one of the things that the Limits to Growth study talked about, is that, you know, the earth can sort of carry a population of people that have very high expectations of their lifestyle, you know, their quality of life. Mm-hmm. Or they can have very low expectations of what their quality of life looks like. And the closer we get as a human population on Earth to the point of where our expectations are high and our carrying capacity is increasingly being absorbed, like we don't have any more room, the more likely we risk the perhaps collapse. And that's where I think a lot of fundraising operations are. And I don't know if engagement, you know, when I was looking at your show notes, I'm thinking this will be a great conversation because I'll be able to throw at him some of the stuff that I'm working on in this book. I don't know if engagement is necessarily going to solve it, because I don't know if an organization, perhaps, I mean, you tell me differently, but the organization now has to have the capacity, the carrying capacity, the you know, you have to have the ability to provide that engagement. And so to provide that engagement also means you put a limit or a cap on the number of donors that you have. Are you kind of piecing all this together? I'm sort of
totally,
rambling.
Totally. But. And I have, you know, so the really pertinent observation, I think, is that I've been looking at VSC data because that's what I do in my spare time. And fortunately, again, my employer gives me really good access. And of course, we all have seen these charts with the alumni participation going down, or maybe we haven't seen it, but there is a chart where you just see the percentage of alumni donors just go down and down and down, and you know, who knows when it's going to stop. What that is kind of hiding is that the number of alumni, of university students, has grown tremendously, right, in the last 10 years. So I don't think development shops have increased even proportionally to that, right? I mean, Jason, do you think that's a fair assumption? So if a university has doubled their number of alumni in the last 10 years, I don't think they've doubled their, or most of them have not doubled their.
Right. I don't. Right. I agree with you. So here, let me throw another wrench into the conversation. So I made a statement. I haven't had anyone really wrestle with this, but I think you're totally more overly qualified to wrestle with this one. So I was doing a speaking engagement in Chicago about 6 months ago, and I made the assertion to this audience, and they didn't like this. I said, as the baby boomer becomes our dominant go-to middle and major donor, so as the baby boomer sort of moves into the place where generally they're the ones writing the majority of the checks that say exceed, you know, gifts that we'd get on Giving Tuesday or something. Mm-hmm. As that donor becomes the sort of the go-to donor, I'm envisioning a baby boomer whose expectations of fundraising are going to go up, which is the engagement you're talking about. I think they're going to expect us to engage, but I also think that their average gift size is going to go down. So what I'm making an argument when I'm generally talking to people, when I'm saying to people, look, when you have to buy somebody a cup of coffee in order to close a $500 gift, that's going to sort of be apple cart shaking. You know, that's going to stir up the apple cart given the way that most fundraising operations are operating.
Yeah. So that's where I see a lot of power in more distributed models. So when we think of engagement, we very often think of it as this one-way thing. Oh, now we have to put on more engagement opportunities, right?
Yeah.
So we have to put on these webcasts and these podcasts and these community building events, and who has the staff to do that? So my team has been analyzing, and you know, the acronym for the higher ed industry association or whatever it's called, CASE, right? Copy and steal everything. Yeah. So we've been talking with Princeton and with some other leading shops. And we found that they use a distributed model where really they're empowering their constituents to do a lot of this. So, you know, there are ways around it if you don't think as organization-centrically as we very often do, right? So you can empower groups to take action on your behalf. You can coordinate with them. That's, as you can imagine, or as I think, you know, will happen, much more, I hate to use the word efficient, but has much more leverage.
Yeah, you see, and I'm totally for that distributed sort of approach, Lewis. But I tend to think that that's where the organizations, larger, especially higher ed shops, are going to lose that sense of control that I think they prefer over efficiency. So I think the distributed, any sort of distributed approach, sort of ensures the organization a greater efficiency. I mean, the more we distribute fundraising activity to volunteers, I think generally speaking, the more efficient it can get. But at the same time, they lose that sense of control and that predictability that I think they're oftentimes looking for. The cocktail that I think we're all sort of rubbing up against is this idea that the Industrial Revolution has given us sort of this sense that predictability, efficiency, predictability, and control can sort of all be assured. I don't think that's possible anymore.
Well, we're in an increasingly complex world. Nonprofits are an order of magnitude more complex than, I would say, a similarly sized for-profit organization. There was this great quote from the CEO of the Atlanta Symphony, and their chair said, you know, you're small, told the CEO of this nonprofit, you're a small $2 million organization, but you're a really complex small $2 million organization, right? Because just think of it, all the programs, and not, you have just this one business, which is providing your mission, and serving whatever you call them, your clients or your beneficiaries. And then you have this other totally different business, which is philanthropy, right? I think acknowledging that, it was really funny that you brought this up, because one of my notes here for today was that efficient doesn't really work in a world that is kind of guided by Pareto's law, you know, and it has exponential returns. So making widgets in a factory is very different, and I think nowadays the easiest way to compare is if you're thinking of these like startups, right, and the models that they're developing for sales, they're very much templated, they're very much about having a process about identifying your persona, right, your buyer persona, and they really advocate for zooming in on this. I find that approach in nonprofit fundraising has, you know, it just brings up a lot of questions for me. You know, it's more efficient if what you're selling is a $10 per month subscription, right? And that's the top range of the value that you have. But in fundraising, it could be $10, it could be $10 million. It's a different way of thinking about it.
So Lewis, put that in order for me. So this idea that efficiency, predictability, and control is sort of a way of thinking that we've inherited from the Industrial Revolution, and maybe fundraising's the last profession that's going to have to come to grips with the fact that we can't have all three. Of those three, efficiency, predictability, and control, which one do you think that the institutions want to be the most, in what order do you think they put them? What's their number one priority of those three?
Oh my goodness, that's a really hard question, and I'm sure you'll have better insight. I think control is, you know, pretty deep-seated behavior.
Yeah.
And it's hard, but at the same time, larger nonprofits, especially higher ed nonprofits, are very used to working in a distributed environment, right? Where what control does, you know, the control that the president has over a university, even a multi-million dollar budget university, is not the same. It's much more about influence, right? At least what I've read. But I would say control is the first, if you ask me, but, you know.
See, I agree with you, and I think that control is the enemy of that distributed that aspiration that your organization has right now to have a more distributed engagement plan, which I think is very admirable. It's what I call in my in the trainings that we do, it's what I call lane one. I think the more distributed you do that engagement and you relinquish control to those volunteers, for example, who cost you presumably cost you very little, if nothing, in comparison to what employees cost you. But you have to surrender control in order to do that. But if a guy like you is also saying that control over those control in those three virtues is the number one priority, that's what concerns me, because I think to have a distributed engagement plan also means relinquishing control.
Yeah, definitely. I wasn't speaking for ourselves. I think we are in a good place there. I was just making, and again, I admit it, a generalization based on not as much knowledge as people that have seen a broad swaths of the industry as probably you have. So an informed guess, but
Wasserman at, and I put the, this was in my first book, Wasserman at Harvard did a study of CEOs, founding CEOs. And he basically, he talked about the inverse relationship between growth and control. Mm-hmm. And
very smart.
And I think that that's exactly what's going to sort of punch us all in the gut. I think that's what's punching us all in the gut, to get back to the original question about engagement and COVID-19 and what's a post COVID-19 sort of world look like. I think it's relinquishing those senses of control in order to maintain what we might call predictable growth.
Well, I was about to mention predictability because I was also thinking about how you typically see organizations shying away from that type of hockey stick in the interest of wanting to be just more predictable. So having the same amount of gifts every month, having the same level of activity. So looking for the constants versus embracing the fact that you're going to make maybe 50% of what you raise in the year in 1 month. Or that striving for exactly the same amount every year of funds raised is going to put you in a position where you're over-focusing on annual fund gifts, probably, right? And that you're not developing those transformational gifts. Again, gross over generalizations here. But I find this fairly typical. And then you're going to actually grow less in the long run because you're just not embracing though. You want too much predictability, and what you're doing is cutting the peaks out of the equation.
Right.
Does that make sense? So you're just averaging, but by the bottom side.
It does. I can see I remember when I was a gift officer in Washington, and our CFO didn't want control. He wasn't a control freak, and he wasn't trying to run our advancement department. What he seemed to want more than anything else was predictability. What people are hearing me talk about typically right now on social media, and certainly what's coming out in this book, is this idea that these three virtues, efficiency, predictability, and control, while they all independently sort of have their value, when you put them together and you put them in front of fundraising, and you put them sort of in this current reality, I think we're talking about a messy sort of
exactly. So what do you prefer? What do you prefer? Do you prefer predictable average results or unpredictable extraordinary results? You know, what's the balance there? Many people prefer the predictable.
No, I think you're going to see, I think the way you put it there, I think you're going to see more, I think you're going to, because so here we get back to some of the growth curves that were talked about in that limits to growth study that I'm getting my head wrapped around. And we're all familiar with this stuff because we've been hearing about it with COVID-19. I think we're going to hear more. I think we're going to see more tolerance of less predictable but more exponential growth potential, if that makes sense. I think we're going to see. I think the annual fund an operation like yours is going to move into more of an exploratory mode and be less concerned about exploiting the predictable value that exists and more, how can we explore the opportunity that exists? And you're going to do that primarily through engagement. And if you think about this, this is the way that a venture capitalist does this. He or she spreads the risk over a number of opportunities, expecting 8 out of 10 of them to be a complete flop, knowing that 2 out of 10 are going to be an exponentially or in our language, transformative sort of gift. And so I could see the annual fund becoming less of a profit center and more of a almost like a research and development center that's sort of fueling highly, highly meaningful engagement. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. So I wrote this white paper a couple of years ago on the future of the annual fund. And it was totally about what this new annual fund looks like, exactly what you said. So doing research, spreading out best practices, learning things, being kind of a little bit of a, I know some shops have their own IT department, but kind of a, you know, if you think of it like a technology hub, so what are the best practices there and measuring and then spreading them out to the other units that do worry about major gifts.
Yeah. And I think so I've had a number of guests on here, Lewis, who've been talking about sort of the usefulness that we're all discovering in platforms, even like you and I. You know, you and I have never been in the room, but we will have now had a meaningful conversation. And perhaps if we had done this on Zoom, we will even know each other in terms of, you know, we'd know who we were if we bumped into each other at a coffee shop. And I think some of the technology that we're now learning, we're developing confidence in, say, for example, Zoom meetings, is actually going to enhance our ability to eventually get to that coffee table.
Absolutely. And I think that should have been the goal all the time. So even our one-way communication should always have been about starting a conversation. There's a way to look at marketing called relationship marketing. But definitely this technology that we have now is fantastic step in the right direction.
So, I mean, I've totally hijacked the conversation, but I don't know if I've gotten as much out of you as you've probably gotten out of me. I think we both came to it with motives to get the other one to talk. But Lewis, I'm really interested. What I'm interested in, because this is the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Are we basically talking about a different fundraiser in the future? So whether they're working in your shop in the annual fund, or whether they're working in a major gifts role or they're doing something else in some small shop, are we talking about somebody who essentially doesn't mirror the fundraiser that of say 5 years ago?
Oh my goodness. So I come to fundraising from a little bit from the outside. So, and just to give you some context for my answer, right? So I grew up in an environment where we didn't really have a lot of fundraising other than religious, probably. And I really do believe so. I think this sales-oriented approach or only, you know, exclusively sales-oriented is going a little bit away. A lot more strategy at the relationship level is what's needed. A better leverage, use of technology. But especially thinking about relationships and engagement more strategically, you know, and I think that's really hard. And I think that's a scarce thing. And, you know, frankly, I still go to my wife to figure out these things out because she's smarter than I am. It's a truly different type of skill set and mindset.
Yes, I see. And that's where you and I could have a lot of fun. I think you're going to see more and more fundraisers. So a lot of the research that I'm doing for the second book is in, you know, it's in economics, it's in psychology, it's sort of the blend of the two when we talk about behavioral economics, it's anthropology. I think you're going to see more of a multidisciplinary sort of approach that's not rooted in advertising and marketing and PR, because I think that's where fundraising sort of loses or has lost some of its perhaps humanity or that relationship factor that you're looking for.
I think they can all be done in a two-way with a two-way approach. So I think marketing is still a splendidly good tool. If done, you know, same with everything, right? If done right. I've spoken with folks in the industry who say, oh, reunions don't work. And I just don't know what to say, you know. If done right, I firmly believe they're a enriching experience for everybody. If you do them poorly, well, then yes, they're probably a horrible experience. So, there's a lot of nuance, right, Jason? I think that the devil is in the details.
Yeah. But even that, that reunion, for example, can we redeem the reunion, the class reunion or whatever, if we sort of let fundraising, for example, take more of a back seat and it's not explicit and we sort of trust the process? I think that's part of what has gotten fundraising in trouble for, say, the last couple of decades, is that it's become so front and center. I remember being in a discussion or watching a discussion. I wasn't in the discussion. I probably commented on it, but one of our colleagues in the fundraising space in higher education was talking about how annual fund operations need to learn how to, in this time, sort of serve their constituencies differently. And then perhaps rather than taking, they need to be giving, which was, in this case, he was suggesting that we need to be helping our alums find jobs. Instead of asking them for $25, we need to be saying, you know, do you have a job? That's a multidisciplinary sort of skill set. And that's a different fundraiser in my mind than the fundraiser you perhaps were hiring 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's hard for me to know, like, these generalizations exactly where they're going. But to me, what you're saying sounds what good fundraisers, you know, Cy Seymour, I don't know, my mentors that I've had throughout my career did. So at some point, it feels like we're just forgetting a little bit of the basics and just, you know, pretending that's just modern fundraising is this way or that way. But I think good fundraising has always been about that. We definitely reunions. That's why I say it's done well. Well, done well, what does done well mean for you? What does it mean for me? For me, done well, a reunion is a life-affirming get-together of peers. You get to reconnect. It's this wonderful value-providing opportunity. But it also has to go hand-in-hand with solicitation and a strategic approach to talking about philanthropy and to getting peers to talk to each other about philanthropy. In all the positive and wonderful ways that philanthropy can make change in this world. So the engagement can also be very high without a lot of results to it if you're not balancing those two, in my view.
Yeah, I don't think those reunions need to go away. I think those reunions, we need to stop putting fundraising so explicitly sort of front and center as if the only purposes for which to get together and give everybody hamburgers and hot dogs is to ask them for money. And when we organize, and I think along the same lines, we'll actually keep some of our employees because they'll be doing the meaningful engagement that you and I sort of started with here. They'll actually enjoy the work more, and the fundraising can become truly an outcome of what is real relationships. I think that's what you're describing, but I think for the last, say, decade, and I think where some of our job descriptions have evolved towards has been far more mechanical, you know, efficiency, predictability, and control sort of being at the center of that. Does that make sense? You follow what I'm saying?
I totally agree with you. And I wish you could come over to Muhlenberg, really.
I think what I'm hearing, if I'm reading in between the lines, you want to be a truly human-centered. You want to acknowledge that these people are going to give generously to you, but you don't want to look at them like consumers, and the only thing you can do is sell them that widget that you referenced earlier.
Yes, exactly. There's a great word called, when you talked about efficiency and all that, it's called autonomation, right? And my pronunciation may be wrong, but it comes from the Toyota production system, which is it's automation with a human touch. So there is I believe there is a middle path where you're benefiting from automation, but you're doing it with a human touch.
And so do you, before I let you go, Lewis, do you manage a team or, so what's the, because part of what excites me, because I'm a guy who's all about talent. And so I'm always asking the question, you know, what is the future of the fundraising professional on the payroll going to look like? Are you shaping and molding a team? And how is the thinking that we're talking about here sort of really sort of getting, yeah, is it getting into the hearts and minds of the people that you're, tell me about your team.
Or am I walking the walk, right?
So Yeah.
Exactly. So we're building this team where the annual fund team is a team of seven. And it's this fantastic group. We are changing. We're looking very carefully at how we measure the traditional contacts, right, and visits. That's a very traditional metric in the profession. And I'm very fortunate to have support from our VP in doing this, but a lot of our work was about engaging people, working with volunteers, working with committees. And all of that was just, oh, it's not a visit. It doesn't count. So you actually have to think about how your metrics are shaping. Basically, metrics are incentives, right? So, you know, and I know you come from an economics background. So if they're incentives, what are you trying to incentivize? I mean, that's the end of it. So we're looking at it. So it's not only visits, but it's also if you work with a committee, we measure our engagement through an algorithm. So we have an engagement score and measure results against that too. So if somebody has a group of volunteers and they have a low engagement score, well, something's wrong, on and on. So it does permeate a lot of the work. We have we were talking about classes and all that work. One of my team members is working with classes to do engagement activities. They're doing happy hours. They're connecting. They're talking all the time. And typically the resistance has been, but that's just so much work, Lewis. You know, we don't have time for that. I think it's the work that needs to get done. It's the important work. And you see the results of it after a while. But this needs to happen first.
Yeah. See, and that's a great place to wrap up because I think what guys like you and me, and the more we preach this, the better. I think it's the work that has to be done, and it's the work that hasn't been getting done, and consequently, I think it's the reason why renewal rates are so low and why goals aren't being achieved is because there wasn't that human, genuine relationship, authentic relationship sort of component, and when we bring that back into it. Which I think the sort of the founders of our profession would say that was always the intent. Mm-hmm. I think the more we'll see, I'm excited about the next 10 years of where we're at. I don't know about you.
I am so excited as well. And maybe you have a much more long-term view of the profession. Was it the case before that, this engagement replenished itself on its own? How did we end up where we are?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that's what, it's interesting you asked that question. I think that we have made them, this is in that Limits to Growth book as well. When you focus on, this is in the Limits to Growth stuff, but this is also in Kahneman's stuff about loss aversion. Mm-hmm. So I think part of what we have done in our field is we have put so much emphasis on the loss of a relationship at the expense of not acknowledging the relationships that we have or the relationships that are going somewhere in a positive direction. And what Kahneman and Tversky were looking at in their research with loss aversion was the idea that this is a whole nother podcast conversation, but when you know, the way that we human beings look at $100. So if we lose $100 and we gain $100, the experience of having lost that $100 is actually more detrimental to our egos and who we are than to have gained the same $100. And so I think in fundraising, we have been unnecessarily putting so much emphasis on the relationships that we're losing every year, knowing we're going to lose them anyway, because that's probably just the way this works. And instead, we need to double and over invest on the relationships that we're keeping. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And indeed, a subject for another podcast. And I'm sure you'll have a brilliant speaker to cover these topics.
Yeah. So, Lewis, you have given me more of a platform today than I've given you. I appreciate that. But if somebody's listened to our conversation today and they want to reach out to you and say, hey, I want to talk to Lewis, how would you suggest that they do that?
So LinkedIn is a good place. Lewis, Louis, and Diez, Diez. I also write in a blog and I share resources. It's Market Lab without the E. So MarketLab.com.
Lewis, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for being my guest today. You're always welcome back. And to our listeners, thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jason. This is a brilliant podcast. Have a great day.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.